Hello all, welcome to the God Said Most podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Draconis Books, which is an independent anarchist press dedicated to publishing socially engaged literature. With me, as always, are Chris Malmberg and Hans Berger, the other two editors of XDB. Today, we are going to talk about a classic novel, Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Chris, you have some questions prepared for us. How do you want to start it off?
I'll start by doing... I did write down a summary this time, and then I can start off with question one after that. So basically, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, it's told by Bromden, the narrator, who's called Chief by the patients and staff in the psychiatric ward. He's called Chief because he's an American Indian. And he's committed there. He's been there so long that everyone just assumes he's deaf. And mute because he never talks nor lets on that he can hear, and he's very protective of that. And the ward is ruled over by Nurse Ratchet, who uses sadistic methods to belittle and control her patients, who are all men. The ward is thrown into disarray when McMurphy arrives. He's a convicted criminal who feigned psychopathy to avoid the labor camps. And he takes it upon himself to make Ratchet as miserable as possible while empowering the guys around him to bend, rewrite, and break the rules of the ward. The fight between him and Ratchet climaxes when Billy, one of the patients, commits suicide. McMurphy then sexually assaults Ratchet and beats her until he is restrained. McMurphy is deemed insane and lobotomized. I don't necessarily know that he's deemed insane, but he's lobotomized and left a vegetable. Ratchet's power over the ward is broken, and the men feel totally fine with disrespecting her forever and happily ever after. The novel ends after Bromden smothers McMurphy and breaks out of the ward.
Excellent summary.
Yeah. It helps to actually write it down.
Yeah. No fat on those bones.
What's that, Hans?
I said no fat on those bones.
That no fat summary on
those bones. Nice, lean, nice, lean, straightforward summary.
Yeah, well, and I'll show my cards with, like, this first question. And we can talk more about why I actually, like, yeah, McMurphy's great. He's just so, like, much, he's so charismatic, he's so interesting, and yet I feel, like, it's complicated, appreciating him as much as like I maybe appreciated him when I was younger. Even just 10 years ago when I last read this book in grad school, which I think all of us were in that same class. And I really, really like Bromden, the narrator. I think he makes this novel. And one of the very first things we see is that he is... I mean, he's in a ward, an asylum, and so it fits that he is so fanciful that he's got delusions, but I don't know if I'd call them delusions because they're really, really insightful. We learn about the world through his kind of wild, fantastical imagery and the things that he sees or senses that like may or may not be there. Just as examples, Nurse Ratchet is like a monster. He sees wires in the walls and tiny machines in the pills, a mind controlling fog. And I think that he's like essential. We can talk about him, but I also am curious just about like narrators like him and writing, you know, a book, a story told. I think it's very interesting that like he's so like he's so fantastic, he's so fanciful and maybe delusional, and yet I don't think that we're really given any like reason to sort of doubt what we're like reading about or anything like that. It's like he's simultaneously extraordinarily trustworthy and yet he's seeing stuff that isn't there. And I don't know, like I kind of wanted to think about it like in terms of sort of like writing a book. Like, how would you, as writers, find a viewpoint character like Bromden? Is it just an accident? Is it something that you sort of decide early on? You know, in my head, I think like McMurphy and the storyline must precede like Bromden, the inception of Bromden for Kesey. I don't necessarily want to get stuck on authorial intent, but I feel like this is a story-driven, you know, novel, not really like something that is led by Bromden's, you know, like voice or like his ability to see stuff that it isn't there, but somehow reveals a deeper truth about what is there. But I was just, I don't know, like, how do you guys sort of see someone like Bromden coming out in a story that you are telling as the narrator?
Well, I mean, I think that you've mentioned a few times Bromden's way of kind of seeing things that are in some sense not literally true or not strictly true, right? But what he's seeing is metaphors. Like, he doesn't really have delusions. You know, if you've ever met somebody that actually has psychotic delusions, they're not neat, right? They don't really make any kind of internal sense, or they're not cohesive by their own rules. But what Bromden has is a vision of the world through a cohesive set of metaphors that develop an alternate way of understanding our day-to-day lives. And so he's able to, because of his status as an insane person, he's actually able to see with what you could consider to be a greater kind of truth by being a little bit divorced from the need to represent everything in a conventionally literal way, right? So as to how do you come into a character like that, I mean, I think like the core of this book is the clash between order and chaos, basically, really, right? I mean, I think that like at the time that it came out, it was often perceived as like a parable about good and evil, right? Like all the quotes that I have on my edition, all the review quotes are about, this is a parable about good and evil, right? And I don't know that you can really, I mean, I think because of some of the ways that McMurphy and his actions have aged, it's hard to read it that way now, but I think if you read it as a parable about chaos and order, right? Or about the linear versus the non-linear, or it reminded me a tiny bit that way of actually Against the Day, right? When we read Against the Day for this podcast, we talked a lot about there's a vision that somebody in an airship has in that novel of all the cattle being herded in neat straight lines into the slaughterhouse, right? That's the combine. And even though Against the Day is written much later, it's from somebody who is of the same generation, right? Pynchon and Kesey were essentially peers, even though, you know, Pynchon kept writing much later. And so I think it shares with Against the Day that sense of its fundamental sympathies are with, its sympathies are against the rigid, the linear, the straight, the orderly. And so with Bromden as a viewpoint character, you have someone who's, his status as a supposedly insane person allows him to kind of see through the surface of things into this metaphor that captures that sense of linearity, rigidity, roboticism that fundamentally Kesey is against. And so, I mean, it seems like, I don't know if the character or the character's ability to understand the themes of the book came first, right? But like the character is, I think, fundamentally essential because he If it weren't for the kind of symbolic thematic framework that Bromden's vision build, we wouldn't really necessarily have an easy way of understanding what it means that this like swaggering drunk Irish person comes in and wants to pinch all the nurses' butts, you know?
Yeah, I think one of the words that came to mind while you were talking is that Bromden is mythologizing something, is mythologizing a kind of a conflict between the like between mythology and order. I'm saying this like in the wrong way, but like it's like there's a sort of a degree of like a desire to value kind of something that is like not like possible, but which sort of like you know, through sort of like magical thinking, like can be made to believe, make people believe is possible. So like McMurphy bets the other patients that he can lift this very heavy thing and throw it through the window, and he can't, but through Bromden's telling, we see something that is like actually like affecting the people around him in a way that like, you know, only a hero like McMurphy can do, which is like through like this effort, he's making them see something that's possible, even if it isn't possible. And like, and the word that comes to mind is like myth making and mythologizing. And so like we need Bromden in order to do that. Because otherwise we're just seeing a guy try to lift something and not being able to lift it. And it's not interesting.
So the fact that Bromden kind of already sees things in this mythologized way makes him the ideal person to lend some kind of meaning and order to this chaotic story.
I guess. I don't know if it's like meaning and order. I feel like actually the story would be kind of meaning and order and boring without him. It would be just like, if it was like a third person story, just like a craft question, like if we were to take out the first person and make it third person, I still feel like it would be like a story. It would still resonate, but it wouldn't feel mythical. Like this feel it like you it's an allegory. It feels like McMurphy and Ratchet are inhabited by like, you know, by like agents, you know, beyond our physical reality, and they're playing out some sort of like larger ideological battle between order and you say chaos, but I think like it's sort of like wild, sort of unbridled masculine sort of, it's very male, whatever it is. Yeah, it's not just chaos. It's like, there's something very manly in this that, and sort of like a traditional idea of kind of a libertarian idea of like someone not being of a man just sort of breaking free of whatever holds him. And I think that like it's still a story, but it doesn't feel like an allegory or like a something quite so fundamental without Bromden. Sure. I love Bromden. I think Bromden makes this story.
Yeah.
Have either of you guys seen the Jack Nicholson movie?
I never have.
No, I haven't either.
Okay. Because essentially, oh, really? I thought at least one of you would have seen it. I mean,
I may have watched it when we read.
That's essentially what they do. Like they.
Sorry, go ahead. That's essentially what they do.
Well, that, you know, you were saying, Chris, that, like, what if they had told this story through a third person perspective instead of Bromden's viewpoint? Well, there's no way to film Bromden's viewpoint, so they just made it a third person story. Like, Bromden is a character, but he's not a central character. He just is kind of like a shadow that is in the movie. So I'm not sure I totally agree with, like, the terms that both of you are using, but I definitely think that I agree that with you, Chris, that without Bromden, you have a much less effective story. For example, the ending of the novel, I think, is an extremely happy ending, because McMurphy in the novel is a main character, but Bromden is our Bromden is the one that we want to figure out what happens to him. We want to know how it's going to go for him. And so the ending of the novel has a deep, the novel has a different emotional arc than the film, and the ending resonates very much in the novel. Whereas in the film, you know, it's harder to feel like something really great has happened when most of the camera stays on McMurphy. And then at the end, you know, Bromden escapes, but you're like, you know, who cares? I didn't really connect with Bromden. Whereas that's not true in the novel. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right that, like, in the novel, at least, Bromden really is, he's the protagonist in the most classic sense, right? Because he's the one who undergoes an arc of change, right, throughout the novel. McMurphy might be kind of a centerpiece,
right?
But ultimately, he's only there as a catalyzing agent for Bromden's change. And Bromden's arc is a completely positive one. So in that sense, even though McMurphy dies, Bromden completes a positive arc and comes out triumphantly. So yeah, it is, you're right, that right, in that sense, it is structurally a quite happy ending.
And there's also, like, the words you guys have been using are like myth making and, like, order versus chaos, and, you know, I'm not that those are wrong, like, I'm not sure that there is a right or wrong about that, but to my mind, I think it seems more about, definitely McMurphy is, you know, is absolutely a libertarian in the American sense, you know, and being a like hands-free type of capitalism where, you know, the innovative and the self-assured and the go-getters actually do get ahead, you know, as opposed to something else. So in that sense, I agree with you, Chris. But otherwise, it seems to me, because of that, it actually seems to be less about order versus chaos versus centralized dominance versus uncentralized or non-centralized dominance. Well, dominance is not the right word. You know, centralization versus non-centralization seems to be the core allegory, I would think. And in a sense, Bromden's ending resonates with that too, since you get the idea that maybe he's going to go back and join his family in resisting, you know, state violence at the Columbia River, where, you know, where his tribe has been displaced.
That's really interesting about centralization versus non-centralization, because I feel like maybe it can help me unpack a little bit of what I think is sort of complicating the aspects of the novel that that are problematic, like especially in the last 10 years. Because obviously,
it's definitely problematic now.
Yeah. Like, the basically, McMurphy, like, the big sort of, like conflict resolves with the bad guy, Nurse Ratched, getting sexually assaulted by McMurphy. And there's a lot in the book that is attacking Ratched, using aspects of her, like, her sex, or the fact that she's a woman. But the thing that I kind of picked up on, and you mentioned centralization versus non-centralization, and I'm not defending the book. I'm just sort of kind of airing something that I wondered if it could be taken as sort of like, I don't know, an interesting angle on like what has become more problematic in the last, you know, few years. They tend to attack Ratched for the things that she does to repress her sexuality, basically, like the things that she's hiding about herself, the things that she conceals, the things that, like, you know, she is not comfortable with her body, and so she hides it. And which is, you know, certainly her right as an autonomous human being, and there's not any, you know, but it also, I feel like that could sort of speak to, could be, you know, added to this idea of like these men and her mission to chop their balls off, which is also problematic, the idea of centralization versus non-centralization, I think it makes me think about sort of the gender politics of this book as being like about like a kind of a resistance to being, you know, forced down a path where, like, you know, the genders are no longer as distinct as they were, which is, you know, maybe a little bit more interesting than just McMurphy is a misogynist.
Right. And I mean, he is, but he definitely is. But, like, I think that's interesting what you're saying, how, like, Ratched is, she's definitely repressed her womanhood, at least in comparison to all the other female characters who are prostitutes. Right? Yeah. So, like, you know, and so I definitely see, like, so if we assume the novel supports McMurphy's side of things, or the Ward's side of things, then the novel supports, you know, promiscuity. The novel supports, you know, open or free love. The novel, and Harding is obviously gay, so the novel supports gay rights and things like that. If we're following this distinction between Ratched, you know, the sexuality of Ratched versus the sexuality of the Ward, so to speak.
It almost seems to me like...
So it definitely seems to me...
Oh, sorry, go ahead. Seems to you.
No. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and maybe this is moving the conversation a couple steps back. I don't know. Maybe this doesn't advance the conversation to make this point, but we were talking about, I had used the phrase order and chaos, and that might be an oversimplified way to describe it. it's like Apollo and Dionysus, right? It's like the combine.
Apollonian versus the Dionysian.
The Apollonian versus the Dionysian, right? And what Kesey's describing and what he saw in 1962 when he was writing this novel was a world where the Apollonian had triumphed over and suppressed the Dionysian, right? And McMurphy is the Dionysian, and he is attempting to restore that balance, right? And part of the process of suppressing the Dionysian is that sense of centralized authority and control that you have pointed to, right? That you have seen as being key. Right. And I think that resonates too with, I don't know if you guys have ever read any of Kesey's other work, but the novel Sometimes a Great Notion. Are you guys familiar with the plot to that or that work?
Mm-mm.
So the novel
I know
that he,
of it. I haven't read it.
Yeah, the novel that he wrote after this, Sometimes a Great Notion. It's been a few years since I read it, but if I remember correctly, it's about a family of independent loggers who are resisting a union boycott or a union picket, right? So like there's a union that runs all the logging in a particular area, and the union is on a general strike for higher wages. And the heroes in Sometimes a Great Notion are this family of independent loggers who are saying, well, fuck that, we're going to keep logging, and are doing various things to circumvent the strike. And their final triumph is basically to get a bunch of wood down the river to the mill in spite of all the things the union is trying to do to enforce the strike against them, which like, obviously, you know, in 2021, it's very, very hard to feel sympathy to that, right? And I think, you know, I've made the comparison of this, for instance, to Pynchon, but I don't think, you know, that's a very anti-Pynchonian sentiment. It just seems like a very right-wing sentiment in a contemporary setting, right? But like, if you think of Kesey as being, as you said, Patrick, somebody who habitually resists or resents any kind of centralized control, then it's a version of that same idea.
Right. He's, yeah, I definitely, an awesome bringing up Apollo and Dionysus. That was fucking great. Like, have you been reading?
I actually got that from Michael Pollan.
I just
Michael
thought that
Pollan
was super cool.
Michael Pollan probably got it from Nietzsche, but that's more where I know that concept from.
The food
writer
guy?
He uses that a lot, actually.
The food writer? Yeah, okay, yeah. Oh, okay. Anyway, I thought that was super cool. Like, awesome, like awesome reference and totally apt. But I was going to say, like, assuming that McMurphy stands in for Kesey's ideas or Kesey's beliefs, then what we have here is a, like, you guys are aware, not, you know, like the political spectrum. So there's left and right, but there's also up and down, right? You guys are aware of like the grid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So like Kesey then is lower right, right? Like he resists centralization, which is typically, typically associated with the upper part of the ideological grid, right? But he also resists socialism, which is the left part of the grid. So, the ideals are American libertarian, and both what you said about his other novel and what, you know, McMurphy is in this novel make me think that's probably, you know, the type of ideology we're supposed to get out of this, which is bullshit. Capitalism is horrible. So
I do wonder, I mean, this was written in 1962, right? And if this had been written even 10 years later,
mm-hmm.
I feel like there are a lot of sensitivities that I would, and I mean, I don't know anything about Kesey or his background or biography, so I'm making a lot of what might be totally unfounded assumptions here, right? But what's essentially happening here that's bothering us is he's privileging this very abstract idea of individualism over other kinds of more particular oppressions and historical inequities, right? Like there's a lot of racism in the way the black orderlies are described, and you can certainly
right, exactly.
And you can certainly, I mean, you can make a reading in which, like, the way that those characters are petty, sadistic tyrants, they are that way because this is the one area in which they are allowed to have some sense of authority and some role, and, you know, some active role. And that's a pathology that's probably being brought out in them by the fact that they have to be in a suborned role in any other setting, right? But,
right.
And I mean, I think you can forgive it with that understanding, but he really doesn't do anything to try to, like, lead us to that understanding, and it almost might just be accidental.
Right.
And, you know, I think that his sense of, again, like, his sense of individual freedom is, you know, there's a way that just completely blinds him to the gender politics of the thing that kind of goes a little bit beyond just like, oh, this hasn't right. aged that well, right? Like but again,
yeah,
I think that I have to think that, like, if this had been written even 10 years later, the way that everybody's ideas and consciousness changed around those issues, I have to think that would have affected how he was approaching the question of individual liberty, right? It's very, very much of its time in that regard. And it struggles, I think, because, like, it's very observant in recognizing and acting against the sort of the ways in which bourgeois capitalist America wants to turn everybody into a repressed automaton, right? That seems like a fair critique, but it doesn't really have anything that seems appealing to offer as a counter to that other than gambling and fucking, right? And, like, 10 years later, there were a whole lot of ideas right. that had been introduced into the broader conversation about how to maybe possibly, you know, craft some sort of more compelling alternative to that. Maybe that didn't work out as a project long term, and that, you know, all that seems its own kind of dated now, right? But it's like he had half of it right and hadn't quite caught up to the rest.
Did the combine win? I this is kind of like an abbreviated form of like a different question that I had, which is like I was wondering like how much like closer the sort of the paranoias and fears and concerns of 1962 are to now than like those of like the Iliad, you know, like, because reading this, I thought like, I get the fear about, a force, a sort of like overwhelming Apollonian force that is convincing, in this case, men to repress like the things in them that make them extraordinary, you know, individuals, and basically kind of like leveling, you know, sort of like chopping off all the angles and sanding down all the rough bits until they're, you know, clean, perfect automatons. And I was trying to kind of connect that with kind of today. And we read this book 10 years ago in a course on paranoia. And I wondered about, because this is a very paranoid novel about, you know, those forces. And then, like, a few years down the road, we're saying that the book would probably be written a little bit differently. And now, 60 years down the road, not a short amount of time, but I feel like the things that, like, that concern us are just very different today. And so, like, you know, do the paranoias of today have anything to do with the paranoias in this book? If they...
Well, let's talk about what the paranoias are in the book so we can figure out... Then we can... Yeah, so what would you say those paranoias are? What's it paranoid about?
I think that, like, Hans talking about 19... About that time, about really the 50s, and the ways in which certain behaviors... it seemed like... obviously, I wasn't alive during the 50s, but as it's depicted, as I've come to understand it, there was a very Apollonian model of the nuclear family, of a man's position in society relative to a woman's position in society, of the American dream and how to achieve that dream. I think that it's sort of held up now by many as a kind of a nostalgic, you know, halcyon age in which, like, the paths forward were extraordinarily clear. And that's because a lot of the noise had been cut out, right? And the noise is sexual deviancy. Or what was portrayed as sexual deviancy, such as homosexuality, or being sexually active, you know, to an extreme outside of marriage, or, you know, being a prostitute or doing drugs, or, you know, all of those things. And it doesn't mean that they didn't happen. It just meant that they were extraordinarily repressed. And the novel Cuckoo's Nest is full of anger about that. And that's all basically kind of like McMurphy. You know, maybe the more interesting, you know, stuff is like with Bromden. You know, do these American, you know, Indians, do these Native Americans fit in this society that we're expanding, that is engulfing everything around, you know, the land that it already has? And, you know, why shouldn't Bromden feel fucking furious about all of this pressure to basically be consumed by this, you know, force for sameness? And I think that, like, that kind of kernel expresses itself in multiple ways in the book. So, like, the paranoia sort of express themselves as paranoias about men no longer allowed to be men, homosexuals, you know, being, you know, like, committed to a ward and treated as you know, defective because of who they are, you know, and Bromden, feeling like he has no place, and there's only, like, a conflict that is impossible to win, to run away from and hide from. Am I getting at it, the paranoias, or is that, or,
I mean, that, is there that something... seems like a good description to me. It seems at least partially those paranoias are still around today. But go on, Hans.
I was just going to say, I do think that those paranoias are still around. I was thinking a little bit about, I mentioned that I had picked up the Apollonian Dionysian model from Michael Pollan. And I first, that he, the first time I heard him talk about that was in his book, The Botany of Desire, which I read when I was probably 19. So that's been in my head for a long, long time. But coincidentally, right around the time that we read this for the podcast, I heard an interview with Michael Pollan about psychedelics and the role of psychedelics. And one thing that they talked about in that interview, it was with Sean Ealing for Vox Conversations. And one thing that they talked about in that interview was the way in which, so now we're moving to a model where psilocybin is, there's a lot of energy in the corner of actually putting it into a legitimate therapeutic context, right? And that's good on the one hand in the way that, you know, any kind of destigmatization, decriminalization of drugs is good. But the other thing that happens there is that in the 60s and basically up until the last 10 years, right, like psychedelics were understood to be something that stood against the homogenizing social order, right, and was corrosive to it and was very dangerous to it in the late 60s and maybe has lost some of that power since then. And the point that that was, I can't remember if it was Paulin or Illing that made the point, but they said that, like, on some level, psychiatric care, therapy, those are fundamentally about preparing people to live productively in society, right? That they're a way of sanding people's rough edges off so that they are able to, you know, fulfill the roles that they have to. And that co-opting psilocybin into that role is a way of converting it from something that is an enemy of the homogenizing social order into something that is ultimately a friend of it, right? And at best, that's mixed, right? That's something that we should look on with skepticism and trepidation, as well as happiness. It's a mix of a positive and negative development in that regard. And hearing those thoughts expressed in that way, in, you know, a significant media outlet suggests to me that, yes, those paranoias are still present. Yeah.
That's fascinating. I never thought about that.
And one thing to just kind of to go off from what you're saying, Hans, you know, I definitely agree that the, you know, Kesey probably wouldn't have used the term capitalism since he seems to be pro-capitalist. But, you know, it does seem like to me that one thing that centralized capitalism does is co-opt these types of things that are counterculture until they become monoculture, right?
Yeah.
So, like you said,
Green Day.
Green Day? Did they? I mean, actually, you said that flippantly, but like that, absolutely. Like, if music and art, like capitalism, definitely co-opts music and art to, you know, it waters it down, you know, makes it lowest common denominator so that it can reach as many people as possible, so it can turn a profit, right?
Yeah.
So if Green Day started out like, you know, like a true grungy punk band saying, you know, being quote unquote anarchists, which, you know, some punk bands say that they are, you know, they're certainly not that anymore, right?
I'll remind you, Patrick, that decades after Nimrod came out, Green Day came out with the scathing, scathing American Idiot song, which I think really nails all of the problems in America right in the heart. Mm.
They really gave the Bush administration what for.
I'm being really sarcastic. I'm being very sarcastic, Patrick.
Okay. I didn't know. I'm not really conversant with, like, Green Day's oeuvre or anything like that. Like, I remember being in seventh grade and thinking Dookie was kind of cool, and there was a song about masturbation, you know? But other than that, I've heard the song American Idiot, but I don't know what it's about.
But I apologize. You were saying capitalism has sort of replaced. Well, it's not that it's replaced. It's just that the combine exists, but it's a combine that co-opts through participation in a way that is sneakier than just some central, like, sort of like cookie cutter agency that's trying to make people look and act all the same.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, like, probably.
It's not so much that it's trying to make everybody look and act the same. It's that it's taking the significance out of looking and acting differently, right? Like, all forms of looking and acting differently are expressions of consumer desire and therefore ultimately toothless.
Right.
So, like, the sign signifier, like there's something happening, like, in the relationship between, like, wearing certain clothes and identifying a certain way. And, you know, being now, because like everyone's able to sort of sample different things, and it's like, I guess, what is hipsterism in this then? Like, hipsterism is what is like the product, the alloy created by capitalism taking in the raw materials of whatever it's taking in, like the more, what would you call it, organic human behaviors that it's commodifying?
I'd have to think about that one.
Say that again.
I'm just thinking, like, yeah, like so hipsterism, the, you know, like, oh my God, look at that hat that douche found at Goodwill and like is now passing himself off like a sort of a French artist from like the 1920s, and he's wearing this, you know, his vest and you know, like he's doing this thing and like, what does it all mean? And it, you know, and it's that question of that kind of that sense of like disdain for people who are like sort of browsing Goodwill for a look or trying to assemble something from, like, you know, I guess the more like, the more problematic, or the problematic's the wrong way of putting it, the more hot example is like people wearing like feathers, you know, or things like that, and sort of like filling, you know, like co-opting images and symbols from other cultures that other people have more authentic connections to. And isn't that hipsterism, where like you're like, you're not like, why do you have a mustache?
I don't know.
Like, no. Okay, maybe.
I don't know. Like, I don't really know what hipsterism, like, a friend of mine a few years ago called me a hipster because I was just wearing normal clothes, like jeans and a sweatshirt or something, but I had these slip-on shoes that were plaid. And so he called me a hipster. And I'm like, okay, I mean, I don't know what it means to be a hipster. Like, there's a Futurama episode that indicates that hipsterism is about doing things ironically, you know, like wearing a shirt that says something from the 80s that you actually hate, but, you know, like, so, okay, so. You guys are like a couple years younger than me, but you probably won't. So you probably won't remember the movie Rad. Okay, it was a movie in the 80s about this guy who's trying to win a BMX race, and you know, it's a fucking great movie. Like, I genuinely, unironically love Rad. At least when I was a kid, I did. And I, you know, if I watch it again, maybe I'd hate it. But if I wore a Rad shirt around, it wouldn't be hipsterism. It wouldn't be ironic, right? I like Rad. But let's say somebody thought Rad was a horrible movie, and, you know, but so horrible that they enjoyed it, then that's hipsterism. Like, hipsterism is Mystery Science Theater 3000, okay, so right?
I'm looking at Wikipedia here. I get it. And I think that this is what it's saying is that irony is one of the things that connects people to these images that are otherwise unauthentic. Mm. But I think my understanding is that it can be other things. So it's like hipsterism defined by claims to authenticity and uniqueness, yet ironically is notably lacking in authenticity and conforms to a collective style. The subculture embodies a particular ethic of consumption that seeks to commodify the idea of rebellion or counterculture without actually, you know, authentically like being any of those things.
Interesting.
And the thing that connects you to that rad shirt, maybe you hate rad, and it can be hipsterism that makes you wear it ironically, but it can also be hipsterism where you just want to look like someone from time period.
Okay.
And someone asks you like, "Oh, I love that movie." And then you're like, "Oh, I've never seen it." Right? That's hipsterism. Basically, like people, and the other example of this is like if someone were to wear a headdress and you're like, "Oh, that's a beautiful Mohican headdress." And then they're like, "Oh, Mohican? I had no idea. I just bought this." It's just sort of like commodifying these things that do mean something. It doesn't have to be irony that connects you to it, though.
Okay. So, like, it seems like hipsterism could be part of capitalistic co-option, or, you know, however you want to say it.
Back to the book. Murphy would hate hipsters, but maybe not. I don't know if he would, but I have my fourth question. Is that if should I ask it now? Like
yeah, do it.
I had a dumb joke I was going to make. My timing is ruined. I was going to say,
what's your joke?
You said I have a fourth question to ask. Should I ask it now? And I was going to say, no, I think now would be a good time to talk about our sponsor, MailChimp.
That is funny.
Oh, man, that's actually funny because I tried to get MailChimp to sponsor XGBots, and they were like, they're like, you don't have enough, like, engagement, dude. Like, you 100 people a month look at your website. Like,
we should talk about MailChimp constantly, and it could be ironic in how we reference them.
Yeah, is there maybe like a hilarious Dutch company that is similar to MailChimp but for Dutch people? Right. Maybe we could get them on board.
Yeah, maybe we could get them on board and start monetize our hobbies. Yeah
Envelope chocolate, that's the Dutch version. All right. So, reading this, I thought about the Wasp Factory, which we also read for this podcast. I also thought about Fight Club.
Really light the read, book. The Wasp Factory.
Very light read. Just breezed through it. Absolutely nothing heavy in that book.
Yeah.
I thought about Fight Club, the book and the movie, and it made me wonder. And I have never read American Psycho. I've seen the movie Lord of the Flies. I just sort of wonder, like, is there a thing where like issues of male violence have to be told, or like we like are just often told for whatever reason through a kind of delusional lens, like a delusional narrator, or kind of like a fever dream where it's unclear what's going on or not. Is that a thing, or is that just in my sample size? Because it just sort of struck me like all of those books have this sense of dislocation from reality, and they all seem to be kind of concerned in various ways and various levels with masculinity, especially I would say like the narratives that sort of inform our collective understanding of masculinity and violence. Just sort of a broad question. I don't know if like you both can probably think of contradictory examples, but I thought I'd float it.
Well, like, no, I think that's a good observation. I mean, like, thinking of Catch-22, which is also about male violence, you know, just on a larger scale, that's very, like, dreamlike and weird, too, you know, the way, like, violence is presented in that novel. And I feel like if you're going to be anti-violence, which I don't know if this novel is anti-violence, but it seems like one way to be anti-violence is to tell it with a like a dreamlike quality, because you can't tell it straight without it feeling exciting or anything like that. If that makes sense. Like, if you just tell it straight, people are like, wow, this is action packed.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point, Patrick. That might be one aspect of it. I honestly, Chris, I've been racking my brain and I don't know that I have a good way to articulate. I think you are picking up on something there, right? And I don't know if I have a good way to articulate what I think it is that leads to that. I wonder if part of it might just have to do with how do you make the book interesting, right? I mean, particularly something like Fight Club, where it's, you know, like something, my sense is that Fight Club is very popular with, you know, men in their late 20s, early 30s, who maybe don't have a lot of other interests that would be conventionally considered intellectual, right? And, or it's stereotypically it is, right? Or it was when it came out. That's the stereotype of it. American Psycho maybe kind of falls into this bracket too. In terms of, you know, explorations of masculinity and violence with an aspect of delusion in them. I think part of it might just have to do with, yeah, with making it seem, with having a hook for the thing, right? Like, if you're going to interrogate those kinds of questions to an audience that might be wary of having that interrogated and wary of what they would usually perceive as highbrow literature, how do you make that engaging and approachable? And adding a certain amount of what you could kind of reductively stylize as weirdness is, it's one way of making something like American Psycho or Fight Club or The Wasp Factory. It just kind of, it adds some zing to it at the most basic level, right? And it adds a particular kind of zing that I think is, you know, like one thing that we talk about sometimes on this podcast is like what the unique advantages of the form of prose fiction are, right? And prose fiction, I think, is it's maybe the form that is best suited to authentically capturing a sense of disconnect from reality in a way that can feel like you can do something that captures a sense of disconnection from reality without a big budget, without a lot of technology, right? The way that you would need to in movies. So it's, I think that it's just like a, as an aesthetic tool to make it approachable to people, it seems like it would be helpful if you're courting the kind of audience that really enjoyed books like Fight Club and American Psycho. Which, I mean, that's an unsatisfying answer because I'm not making a thematic point of it, right? But it's the best I got.
I think it's a good answer.
Yeah. So, Hans, what are we going to read next time?
Yeah, so my pick for next time is the book Heaven by Miyako Kawakami. It is, I read a review of it that described it as an interrogation. It was originally written in Japanese, so we'll be reading it in translation. And it is to my understanding, an interrogation of Nietzschean philosophy set in a Japanese high school.
Hmm. Huh. Sounds interesting. Very interesting, actually. I wonder. That intrigues me. I mean, I definitely. I don't know anything about the novel, so.
Right, and it might suck. I'm not. I have not read it myself. You know, I'm going into this one blind, so I have no guarantee that it will be good at all. But I guess we'll find out.
Right. Sure. Well, you know, like we could purposely pick bad novels so we could have like another The Vore podcast, where we just get to feel superior. That's always fun, right?
But then we have to read it.
Yeah.
And I say that having been the one to pick it.
Yeah, we can pick short,
you know,
bad novels.
I don't know if feeling superior is. Yeah. Yeah, feeling superior probably isn't worth, you know, like 550 pages of badness, maybe 200 pages of badness.
250 at the max.
Anyway,
yeah.
Okay. Other thoughts before we sign off? Like, in case we missed anything.
I think I'm satisfied.
Nope.
All right. Yeah. Good discussion. You guys always manage to make me laugh and you know, give me a positive spin on my day, even if it's for only a few more hours. So yeah, awesome talking to you guys. Listeners, I hope you have enjoyed our discussion of Ken Kesey's novel, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which, you know, interesting, complicated, enjoyable novel, even if it is deeply problematic, you know, with problematic depictions of women, problematic, you know, potentially racist language, and, you know, some weird idea that somehow bosses and employees can be a good thing, but okay.
I was also very disturbed by the depiction of fish.
Oh, were you?
No, I'm being an asshole. I'm
like
sorry.
I was trying to think. I was like racking my brain. Like, what was wrong with the depictions of fish? I mean, yeah, there were like innards and whatnot, but did they cut the salmon open, or was it not a salmon?
My issue with it was that actually they avoided discussing the deep-seated violence involved in fishing. Right? I wish they had gone into more.
Really, kind of
made us confront, you know, the cruelty of sport fishing.
Are you fucking with me now? Like, I mean, certainly fishing is.
I guess I am, and I'm not.
Like fishing,
I mean,
and hunting are violent.
I am fucking with you to the extent that I would expect anybody to care about the thing that I'm talking about. I do actually think sport fishing is kind of needlessly cruel and violent, but I mean, I also kind of feel like we probably have bigger problems, you know? Like, it's not. If we get to a point where there aren't other things to focus our moral opprobrium on, then we'll be doing good, you know? So.
Sure.
So I'm half joking, half not, I guess.
I gotcha. All right, listeners, I hope you have enjoyed our discussion of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. You know, interesting pick, Chris. I enjoyed rereading it. And okay, peace out until next time, everyone.